Oh, hello, Captain. How are you, my friend?
How are you doing?
What's going on, pal?
It's been editing upon editing for this 6-part series that we put out.
Well, you know what? Let's jump right to that. We'll shoot ahead. Tell me about the new podcast, Shaker Heights.
Yeah, it's just it's a 6-part series. It's a case that me and Nick have looked into several times, and then it was reported on by James Renner. James Renner kind of approached us with this idea that he had the transcripts of the actual interviews between the detectives and different people involved in the case. And he said, well, what if we told it in such a way where the listeners could hear the actual interviews that were done by the detectives?
I'm sorry, Captain. I was going to tell you, sell me on the case. Tell me exactly what Shaker Heights is for those who don't know.
It was a girl named Lisa Pruitt, and her boyfriend just got out of a mental institution. And there's some conflict there between, his name was Dan Dryford. The Dryford family had some issues. And the day that he got out, she was supposed to come by later that night to visit him. They heard some screams, and they found her body. So it's early 90s. Mm-hmm. It was in Shaker Heights, which is basically a suburb of Cleveland. But it's very reminiscent of Serial, like the Adnan Syed case, but just 9 years before.
Did you enjoy doing this different kind of stuff? Because I've had James Renner on here. You've had him on. He's a great reporter. He delves into so much stuff. Did you like doing it with the detectives' interviews? Did you like that, or did you like you and Nick talking more?
It was just, we wanted to do something different just to switch things up. It became such a workload. You know, when we started podcasting, and still podcasting is kind of the wild, wild west. Mm-hmm. And you can still start a podcast from your garage like we did and have success. And, you know, that's what Nick does for a full-time job now. But to take on a project like this, there's been a lot of shows that started in a garage that now have a staff of people. We don't have a staff of people. It's still 90-some% of everything that we do is just me and Nick, from the website to uploading the shows to social media. And there's so many times that I reply to somebody and they just assume that I'm some, website administrator or something. And I'm like, no, it's still actually me. And we do have somebody that helps us out with Facebook. But again, 9 out of 10 times when you get replied to on Facebook, it's probably me. So the research is done still by us. We do have somebody that helps us now with some fact checking on some things. We like to double check almost every piece of information we get, even if it's maybe a silly piece of information. So we do have somebody helping with that. And once we started doing merchandise, we have somebody that kind of helps us here and there with the merchandise. But again, I'd say, 90% of everything that we, or 95% of everything we do is still run by two individuals. And sometimes it's just way too much. We bite off way more than we can chew.
And with Shaker Heights, as you're doing it, you're like, oh shit, this might have been a little much, or was it? Were you like okay with it?
It was. There were some episodes. a typical episode, if the episode's an hour long, I edit as we go, mm-hmm. which is very abnormal. But the reason why I do that is because, why should I have to sit in a room for a couple of hours and why Nick gets to watch football? So, but this one, we recorded all the parts individually, then started putting it together. And last night, for example, there was a 20-minute section that probably took me 3 hours.
Oh.
So it was just very tedious. And like I said, we bit off maybe more than we could chew. But it's so funny, too, because so many of the listeners are like, oh, this new format's great.
Oh, no.
Or the new format sucks. And you're like, this is not a new format. This is just a 6-part series. And then we're moving on, you know, back to the regular show.
Captain, when during the editing did you want to punch James Renner in the face for suggesting this case to you?
Well, it's really kind of interesting because James Renner and Nick are pretty close. Before we even started the podcast, I'll never forget, because everybody always talks about how interesting it is that, like, especially when you create something from nothing and then it actually there's some success, people kind of want to know what the story is. And the story probably starts way back, you know, being in elementary school and talking about unsolved mysteries and some of the cases that we talked about in elementary school. But I still remember probably, I'd say maybe a year or so before we started the podcast, that Nick told me, hey, I was driving to a gig and he was driving. That's why he gave me a call and we ended up talking about cases for about an hour and a half. And I said, well, where are you driving to? He goes, I'm driving to listen to this author speak about his book.
Wow.
And then the next day I give him a buzz. Hey, how did that thing with the author go? Oh, it went pretty good. I chased him out in the parking lot and asked him all these questions. And I kind of weirded the guy out. And then cut to a couple years later, James Renner coming down and us renting out a studio to have him do an interview with us. And the, you know, James pops into the studio and Nick says, nice to meet you. We've met before. And right away, Renner goes, yeah, you followed me out to the parking lot one day. You know, so, you know, and they've done some really good stuff together. They got a project called, I believe it's called the Porch Light Project. And there's a bunch of different people that are involved. But what they've been doing is taking cases that maybe need funding raised to get DNA tests done, or if there's some other test that needs to be done that maybe a police department doesn't have the funding to do, they've been taking on things like that. So, and then on the flip side, I've got to know a lot more people involved with the Mara Murray case, and me and James heavily disagree a lot on that case, and also maybe in the way in which he's gone about some of that stuff in that case. Mm-hmm. And that recently came out because I did a couple of interviews and I kept on getting all these emails and these text messages. Oh man, you're bashing this guy and you're really attacking him, you know? And I'm like, I didn't feel like I was attacking him. I felt like I've said all this stuff to his face, you know, so there's no issue here. You know, he knows what we disagree on. Mm-hmm. So then within, you know, a couple of weeks of just, it was like our Twitter was just Mara Murray and James Renner for about 2 weeks, and which was hilarious, knowing that Shaker Heights was coming out. A project that we worked together on. So I think the message that we're trying to send is, and not just me and Nick, but also James Renner, is we're not always going to agree on everything, but our intentions hopefully are good, and it's okay to disagree, because I think so much in the true crime community, it's like not okay to have different opinions. And so I think we're trying to show we don't agree on everything. Even with the Shaker Heights thing, I don't think James's viewpoints on some of the pieces of evidence of that case are the same as mine. But that's okay, because without some conflict, without some disagreeing, you're not going to get to other ideas or other leads.
You said it perfectly, because without conflict and disagreements, when you do that, you might be able to enlighten the other person, maybe put a light bulb on, like, holy shit, I never thought of that idea, and another route to go down. Because after a certain while, you know, Captain, after a certain time, it's just cold and you're just treading the same tracks over and over. You need, you know, new blood in there. So that's why conversations about stuff are different. But you mentioned Shaker Heights in Ohio. You're a proud Ohio guy. How is Ohio right now?
It's cold right now. I'm hoping that it warms up in the next couple weeks.
When are you getting to the Big Apple? I invited you out here, and I feel like I'm a spurned friend. You spurn my advances when I invite you to the Big Apple.
Well, no, it's funny, because I was just talking to not Paul Holes, but I was talking, I mean, this happens with Kim and Lance from Crawl Space. Mm-hmm. Billy Jensen just messaged me 2 days ago. He said, Billy Jensen just puts out a book. I mean, he's on TV. He's famous.
Yeah.
Sends me a message. When are you coming out to LA? I'm like, I don't have like some schedule where I have to be in LA ever.
Yeah.
Or that I ever have to go to New York. I mean, back in the day when I traveled for music, I would get to go to New York. I only played one place there. I played there multiple times. It's called Lion's Den. It was right by...
Of course, in the Village, of course.
Yeah. Yeah. And I played there multiple times, sold it out a couple times.
That's a great spot. I lived like five blocks from that. That's a great spot.
Yeah, it was a great spot, but now I have no reason to to go to New York. Not that I don't want to.
Of
so
course.
Anytime I get invites, like you invited me, and like I said, Billy Jensen, I mean...
He's more famous than me. Come on, go out to L.A.
Billy is just—he's just a good guy, and he's fun to have a beer with. But it's just so funny how casual he is, like about, hey, come out to L.A. You know, when are you coming out? Like, nobody else wants me out there, Billy. But
only Billy
out to L.A. just for you.
You mentioned the music. You still playing a lot of gigs? First of all, the music on the podcast lately has been on fire. It's been sounding great. I know you do the music. Have you been playing a lot of gigs lately?
No. I think that's the thing. Like, I think with Nick, he's always had true crime as a part of his identity.
Okay.
But I was just one of his friends that he could talk to about cases with, you know? So music has always been part of my identity. And then when we do the show, and still to this day, if we get a bad review, it's always that they hate me. They love Nick, but they hate me. And so it's been weird, but I haven't played. I'll pick up some gigs here and there. I'll fill in with some people. I'll play the show. Just the amount of work it takes. By the time I hit the weekend, the last thing I want to do is to go hang out in a bar till 2 o'clock in the morning. But I still play maybe once a month, if that. But but the show has allowed me to spend more time on recording music and the production side of music. Mm-hmm. And so I get to buy some cool toys. So I have a lot more toys.
And less gigs.
Yeah, and less gigs, which is so funny because I think that at the top point of me playing, I own like, I was teaching 40 some kids a week. I was playing 2 to 3 gigs a week on average. I was averaging almost 200 gigs a week or a year. And I had one bass and one guitar. And that was it. And now I play maybe 12 times a year. And I couldn't even tell you how many guitars and basses I have. It's ridiculous. And so,
I love it. I absolutely love that. You're pigeonholed as the crime guy. So every interview you do is crime, crime, crime. Besides crime, I know music. What else are you into?
Well, it's funny because, like, if Nick shows up and he's in a bad mood, mm-hmm. all I have to do is bring up NFL or college football.
Okay.
And he'll just start yapping. He just goes and goes and goes. And we still talk. I mean, because me and Nick played in a band for about 6 years. And so we still talk about music here and there. But always been into sports. But the funny thing is when growing up and you're a musician, you start getting to this idea of like, it has to be music all the time, uh-huh. right? Like
it has to consume your life. Yeah.
Yeah, but it really doesn't, because it's the experiences of life that really kind of shape you as an artist. So if all you're doing is practicing guitar or practicing bass or whatever it is, then that's all you know as an individual. So then it just becomes, you almost are creating music for only people that play music. And so I think with, like the podcast lately, I've been getting a lot of compliments saying, man, this music's been great. But I think that's also because I got some different production stuff, mm-hmm. and it's really like geared towards a little more aggressive, I'd say, a little more rock and roll. Mm-hmm. But no, so it's weird because I was so focused, singularly focused on music. And then once I started playing 2-3 nights a week, well, what's on at the bars, NBA, you know, NFL, college football. And that really brought me back to, you know, watching that stuff. So I'm into sports and stuff, but I'm also really like a sick addiction into movies.
Really? And you know what's funny, Cap, because sports is my life. So that's all. I only care about sports, reading, and traveling. Movies, I've maybe watched 20 movies my whole life. That's it. I just find nothing intriguing about them. So you're just a movie fanatic?
Yeah. So if you said, like, give me your top 10, every single one I would give you, I've probably watched over 20 times.
Really?
Yeah, I've just got into the HBO series, The Outsider.
Okay.
And I'm the nerd that, you know, when they put the, like, after the episode is released, here's a 5-minute clip of behind the scenes or whatever.
And you watch it.
And I watch that stuff. And I just love it. And it's also funny, too, because there's also, like, scenes of movies that would like make you cry, mm-hmm. that they used to make me cry, but I've watched them so many times that now I find them hysterical. So then I'll be watching a scene with somebody like, hey, remember the scene from Forrest Gump or Good Will Hunting or Rudy or whatever it is. And they're like, oh yeah, this is such a sad scene. And I start breaking down everything that's funny about the scene. And they just kind of look at me like I'm thick and twisted. So
Ohio guy, are your things the Ohio State University football, the Browns and the Cavs? Are those your three things, or what is your favorite?
Well, yeah, I've always been an Ohio State guy. As far as NFL, it's hard to root for losers your whole life. So the Browns, but I'm not one of those guys that are like, Browns are number one.
Yeah.
And then I have another team.
Gotcha.
Normally, I have another team, and then the Browns are number two.
Okay. So who's your other team?
The Patriots. which people just hate. And I don't know how they became. Just any time that they were on TV, I just found myself, rearranging my day to watch them. And I don't like Tom Brady. So figure that one out. Great. Figure that out. I think Tom Brady is completely overrated, but I'm a Patriots fan, so it makes zero sense. But the Browns have been fun to watch lately. And for some reason, I don't like Cincinnati. So I'm all kinds of mixed up.
You're all messed up. Listen, grab a beer. Let's talk some true crime, because I'm happy to be talking to the Michael Jordan of the podcast. Are you tired of carrying Nick around on your back, carrying that show?
I wish I was the Michael Jordan of true crime. I'm lucky if I'm John Paxton.
John Paxton hits a big shot here and there, Captain. So don't sell yourself short.
That's a deep reference. Some people are going to have to Google who John Paxton.
John Paxton, number five. You don't mention it many times on the show, but I remember last time we spoke, you said your father's a retired detective. Is he a listener of true crime, of True Crime in the Garage?
Yeah, he really likes the intros. and then I think they put him to sleep. So I think he makes it through the intro and then like the first part of the case, and then he falls asleep. So he's constantly telling me, "Oh yeah, I just listened to your one show about the one guy that went missing from the one place." I'm like, what a detective, right? What a detective. Can't even remember the people's names.
Did you ever think of following in his footsteps and maybe going in the law enforcement route?
Oh, there was like at least three times in my life.
Really?
That I went to him first.
Okay.
Like, I have to make a change. I have to do something with my life. What am I interested in? Mm-hmm. And like, going back to the whole like podcast thing, the podcast blows up and the next thing you know, you're the captain. And I'm like, the captain was just a nickname that we came up with for the show. So people think that like in my real life, people call me the captain, and that's like not the case at all, so now that's what I'm called. Because my friends will pick on me. So it's constantly wrestling with, when you think you're set on this earth to do something, mm-hmm. but the universe is telling you, hey, it's not working out for you. I mean, I always made a living, but I was really struggling, because I always kept music as a priority. Even if I had a day job, the music was a priority. And so there's several times that I called my father up and said, "Hey, looking at going back to school, and I really think I would be good as a police officer, not even a detective. I just thought we live in a society right now where not all police officers." My dad believed in serving and protecting, mm-hmm. and the first one being the most important, and really kind of champion against some of these, like basically in my town that I live in, or that I grew up in, don't live there anymore, but that I grew up in, they stopped giving speeding tickets, if you're 5 miles over. They basically said, look, if they're not 6 miles over to 10 miles over, don't even waste your time. That's not the job of a police officer. So he really kind of instilled that in me, that what he was doing was serving the community. And so there was a couple times that I thought, at least in my town, they make a decent living. Mm-hmm. it's a stressful job and still might be somewhat dangerous, but probably not as dangerous as it would be in a major city. Mm-hmm. So I'd go, okay, well, maybe I'll do that. And every time I'd bring it up to him, he was very much against it. And, well, I think it's just, I don't think the average person understands how much control a department has over the individual.
Oh, you miss birthdays, holidays, the hours you work, taking the work home with you, of course. So he was looking out for you, yeah. You think?
Yeah, and then, like, people go, well, but they got all these great benefits, and they get these special duties and things like that. It's like, you know, my father, not only did he retire from the police department, but he got a retirement from a local horse racing track because he worked there special duty for 20 years.
Oh, wow.
Got a special retirement through a church because he worked there bingo for over 20 years. And so when your father, I think that's the other thing too, is that people then think, well, your father was a detective, so you must know about crimes in a different way. No, because especially when you're a detective, it's not your job to go home and tell your wife everything that's going on in the case.
Of course. Yeah. Remember, you know, you want your home to be a happy place. So you leave work, whatever your work is. Captain, that's why when I love having you on, we don't just sit here and talk true crime. That's your job. You don't want to talk it every second of your life.
Right. And that's why, like, when Nick shows up a little grumpy, I bring up football.
Yeah.
You know, so. I also think my father believed that, you know, this case is private. And he wouldn't talk about his cases that often. And my parents split up when I was around ninth grade. Mm-hmm. And there's four kids total, but I went to live with my father, so then I became like an only child of a detective, and that's when I really started seeing like the effects of the job and how it wore on him as an individual. I think he's very proud that I'm doing something that's loosely based in his field. Mm-hmm. But he's given me some great insight when we talk about a missing person case. And, you know, he did over 4,000 missing person cases. I mean, that's a lot. You know, I'll be lucky if True Crime Garage does 4,000 episodes. So I think he's proud in that sense. But sometimes when I'm bashing the police or I'm saying the police got this wrong, he starts going, what's wrong with this kid?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think he's proud of it, but also in a weird way, like there's definitely been times where I think it's kind of like hurt his feelings in a way. Mm-hmm. That like, you know, basically these two idiots in a garage can talk about crime and make a living and run their own schedule. And that he was so controlled by a department, and not like in a bad way. I mean, I think he's grateful for everything he got from the department, but he retired when he was 46 years old. Mm-hmm. Due to disability. I mean, when you get to the point where you have to take a physical test and they tell you, we can't allow you to take the test because you could end up paralyzed. And that's how somebody's retiring and just all the stuff that it affects. I mean, I don't play golf often, but when I do, he doesn't swing like a normal person because he can't. He is constantly taking steam showers and sauna trips and hot tub trips from the amount of, and I think some of it is being a street cop, but I think a lot of that stuff was the the weight training he did to stay in shape, the hours and days he was on his feet. And it wasn't really till he retired and then starting the show that we've actually talked more. I mean, he worked for State Highway Patrol, but the first day he was on at his department, there was a local lady that was stabbed 40 times in a gas station. And he walks in to report for duty, and they say, hey, go to this gas station, and your only job is to sit there and not let anybody in or out. And he said that he was there for 30-some hours, you know, straight, because, you know, he's like, I think they just forgot about me. You know, and so you're just sitting there, and also just like one of a good friend of my brothers and sisters, a kid that lived a block away, their father took his own life. And I remember hearing about it at school and not seeing my dad for a week. And when I did see him, I remember his clothes looked worse and worse every time I saw him. Same outfit. And his beard, he had no facial hair, but because he was working so long and so many hours trying to figure out if this was a suicide or not, and he's gone for days upon days. I mean, that's the stuff I remember as a kid. My dad didn't sit around with some, you know, detective hat, smoking a pipe, going to the library to look up, you know, ancient, you know,
ancient cult cases or anything.
Yeah, cult rituals. That's not the stuff he was doing, not the stuff that they make into TV shows. He was doing...
He was doing real police work. He was putting his boots to the ground, Captain. That's what he was doing.
Yeah, and a lot of times with detectives, it's your ear on the phone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just waiting for tips to come in, this and that.
Yeah, and my dad told me one time, I was working as a banker and my dad always loved that I was a banker. Like, that was my dad's favorite job of mine, because he was such a big Seinfeld fan that there's the episode Newman or Kramer always wanted to be a banker.
Yeah.
So
the parking, the speeding, the
3 years.
Yeah. The ticket.
Yeah. But to this day, if we bring up banking, my dad always says, well, you always wanted to be a banker. but my boss was really getting on me, you know, about not dressing as nice as I could. And then my dad told me that he could wear jeans to work if he wanted to. There was no dress code for the detectives, other than they could have they had to have a collared shirt, you know. Mm-hmm. But so my dad could have showed up with dress pants and a polo, or jeans and a polo, or khakis and a polo. He wore top of the line suits and ties, and every detective other than him did not wear a tie, and they would make fun of him constantly. Now, this is the head detective of a small unit. If there's a murder, he is the head detective. But he always told me that it was so important for him to dress nicer than everybody in the building, because once he got into a building, he said there was two things I needed to do my job. Access to the building. Well, three things. Access to the building. And once you got into the building, access to a phone and a good cup of coffee. So, because a lot of times with detective work, it's following those leads, making calls. Mm-hmm. Yes, there is some get in the car, drive over to somebody's house, knock on the door. But a lot of times it's, let's call them first. Let's see if they're even there. Let's see if they're even going to be willing to talk to us. Mm-hmm. You know, I wish I knew more about certain things. And we've actually talked about doing a podcast with him where I think it'd be interesting for people to hear why somebody chose that profession and what their intention was to do that profession.
On the, I'm going to piggyback on the law enforcement thing. And first of all, thanks for opening up about your dad, man. That was really cool. But as the show gets bigger and bigger, you told me last time that agencies have reached out to you about a case of that. Because the popularity of the show, and you guys are, obviously you throw a joke in here or two, but you're a serious show. You guys do a great job and a great service. Have law enforcement agencies, more of them, reached out to you guys about cases, about your opinion, what, hey, can you guys do a story on this and maybe get the word out?
Well, with the Tyler Davis case, it's a missing person case. He went missing over a year ago, or roughly about a year ago this month. And I was, tons of people were contacting us online saying, you should cover this case. It's kind of like Brian Schaefer. So, one of my friends actually said, well, I know his wife. So I reached out to the wife to see, hey, there's not a lot of coverage of your husband's case. Would you want to talk about it? And she was so busy with stuff. And, you know, she's, you know, you have a missing husband, but you still have a child you have to raise. And you have a job you have to go to. And this was, you know, probably a month after he went missing. I talked to her on the phone and she seemed so like gung-ho about doing the interview. Mm-hmm. And then she just kind of kept coming up with these excuses. I mean, you know how it is. I gave you like 10 not to be on the show. You know, I think my grandfather died like 6 times.
Yeah, I sent flowers 5 times out to Ohio, Captain. Come on.
Yeah. I sent flowers 5 times. So then I contacted the missing person unit. And they're the ones that actually said, hey, look, we've talked to her, but we'd really be interested to see what she had to say to somebody that wasn't law enforcement. So they kind of gave me some strategies to maybe try to entice her a little bit to do the interview. And we've had a couple of times where I'll get an email from somebody that's worked on a case that said, hey, thanks for covering the case. And then lately we've had a couple retired detectives that are still working on cases. Mm-hmm. That if a case is pretty cold and nobody's really talking about it, that's why we've done some of the cases we've done, because to be able to talk to actual law enforcement, or in several of these cases, not only have we been able to talk to law enforcement, we're talking to the family, we're talking to the lead detective, we're talking to 2 retired detectives that worked the case. So you're getting information that you can't find anywhere online. So that make it feel like so much more real. And the stress becomes more real. A couple weeks ago, I was able, you know, I've been really fascinated with the Mara Murray case, and I met Julie Murray, Mara's sister.
Fascinating podcast you did, by the way. You were unbelievable in that podcast.
Well, it's so funny, though, because this is a lady that loves her sister. She's done as much publicity as she could. Her dad kind of has led the case, kind of been the spearhead. And then now, as her father's getting older, she's realizing that he might not be able to see this through. Mm-hmm. And she has become determined to see it through. And in doing so, then she goes, well, we got these tests, we got these experts, and the experts, they don't want money for the actual test. They want money for the travel. They don't want to get paid. They just don't want to have to pay out of pocket.
Sure.
You know, so it's like, so she basically was like, look, I can do an interview with this show. And she, but she wanted to get to know me. And she talked so much shit to me over the phone and like through text messages. Playful, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so to do that interview, like, I tried to keep it as light and friendly, knowing how nervous she was about it. And it's just so funny because some people love that interview, and I've got like hate mail saying,
of course,
that I'm a scumbag because I was flirting with her.
But you know why that's messed up and that bothers? Because I went on Reddit. I go on Reddit very, very rarely. It's a vile place. And I went on after that interview because I was pissed at you guys. Well, pissed at you because you brought me down that rabbit hole again with Maura Murray. I was kind of away from that, Cap. And people were like, oh, you know, he was flirting. He would. But that's your – I don't want to say shtick, but that's your personality, and that's how you get people to open up. So I thought that was very unfair. But I want to piggyback one more time on the Maura Murray thing. Why is it – and you might know it better than anybody – certain cases forever are hot-button issues. Maura Murray, you and I talked last time about the West Memphis 3, JonBenet, Madeleine McCain. Why do certain cases just consume us? And why is case A – because Tyler Davies is a case that when you hear about it, you're like, oh, my God, this is fascinating. But yet it doesn't get the crazy press that the other ones do. Why is it certain cases just blow up?
I think that's a good question. And then it's it becomes the chicken or the egg question, right? Because all those cases, people that have an opinion of what happened or what they think happened, their opinions are very strong. They're almost as strong as like political opinions or religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you see that in the West Memphis 3 case. You see that, like you said, JonBenet Ramsey, Maura Murray. But do those strong opinions, I think those strong opinions actually attract more people.
Because people are so passionate about it. That passion is just, it's magnetic.
Yeah, and I think, and then what happens in those cases, in those particular cases anyways, is when they blow up like that, it's the amount of information. So, like, Brian Schaefer is a case that fascinates a lot of people. The amount of information, when we were talking to TV executives and they were saying, we'd love to do a show with you, we'd love to do a documentary, and Nick's not hugely fascinated with the Brian Schaefer case. I am. And then logistically, if you're going to do a documentary with these two, you know, idiots from a garage, do it in their backyard, because logistically it's going to save your company tons of money. But the amount of information, like actual factual information of that case, is very small. But I would argue that even like with the Maura Murray case, the actual factual information is pretty small, but the speculative information is vast.
Oof.
And if you dive into Maura Murray, for example, I mean, I know of one book. I know of another book that will eventually be coming out. It has a 6-part documentary series on Octagen. It's been covered on 5 different other shows. There's a whole podcast. Well, there's multiple podcasts that are dedicated just to that case. There's blogs that are dedicated to that case. So the amount of information, I think, is also what really keeps those cases so big. Because if you dive into OJ, you can spend days upon days upon days reading things. And all the cases that you talked about, JonBenet Ramsey, for example, there are multiple websites that have thousands of pieces of information and pictures and maps. And you can really sink your teeth into it. I think something like the Tyler Davis case, for example, guy goes missing in Columbus, Ohio. Yeah, there's a two-hour interview with True Crime Garage and maybe a couple other podcasts that have covered the case, but their episodes are going to be less than 2 hours. There hasn't been a documentary made about it. There's not much information. And so I think it's hard for that case to keep in the spotlight because there's not a lot of information.
Personal level, do you feel prefer discussing murder cases or missing persons? Which is do you find, I hate to use the word funner because that's ridiculous. Which do you find more intriguing to talk about on your podcast, missing persons or murders?
Well, I think, yeah, like you said, I mean, I think there's some stuff in the true crime community that we need to get past, right? We got to get past a couple things. One, not every victim, let's just take murder victim, or if you want to consider a missing person a victim, mm-hmm. I would.
Of course.
But, and we kind of talked about this on Off the Record, which is our little bonus show that we do every other week or whatever it is. But we got to start getting past a couple things. One, it's okay to say my favorite case, right? You know, there's too many, there's millions and millions of people that are fascinated by cases. And maybe favorite's not the best word, but hey, let's just get over it. What's your favorite case? Who's your favorite serial killer,
yeah,
right?
You're allowed to have like, that.
Let's just get over it. If people can have a favorite football team, all football is a bunch of grown men that are wearing pads, dressing up in silly uniforms, smashing each other, you know, smashing into each other, trying to get one ball across the other ball. And we decided, for whatever reason, the ball needs to be this size and the field needs to be this big. So it's all kind of silly anyways. So let's just get past that. You're allowed to have a favorite case. You're allowed to have a favorite missing person. You're allowed to have, and really what you're saying is these are cases that connect to me somehow. Let's get past that. Let's get past the idea that every victim was a shining superstar.
And so innocent. Yeah, they lit up a room when they walked in it. That's not always the case.
Right, because when I walk into a room, it gets dim, right? I'm a snarky son of a bitch, and that's just how I'm going to be. If there's some buttons of yours to push, I'll push them just mm-hmm. for fun. But if I go missing and you say I lit up a room, I mean, unless I lit the place on fire.
Yeah, that's a flat-out lie.
It's just a lie. It's not true. Now, I also understand that you can't victim bash, but we've covered some of these cases where you find out that the person that got murdered had a drug addiction. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a horrible thing, you know. But we got to get past some of this stuff. And also, I think because the cases that people present in a light of this person lit up the room, this person was an amazing person, that those cases normally get more attention. You know, if you look at some of the, they call it the missing white girl syndrome, right? Mm-hmm. Those cases become huge. And why do they be? I mean, we've covered cases that were within miles of the Casey Anthony case. Same situation, missing toddler.
And nothing.
White.
Yes, I know.
But poor.
Mm-hmm.
Like everybody. Now, and the thing, too, is, you know, the list Long Island serial killer case is fascinating to me. And Shannon Gilbert, I think, is a saint. Here's a girl that she was a sex worker, but she mattered enough to her family to want answers, and they still never got answers. And it's a case that needs to be studied more, and it's a case that people need to be more outraged by. She is hired by all these individuals at a party, ends up leaving, calling 911, saying that they're trying to kill me. Mm-hmm. And if she wasn't a sex worker, this would be the number one talked about case in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a sex worker, so therefore she doesn't light up the room. Well, maybe at one point she did, right? And it's not my place to tell people if they, you know, if sex working is a good thing or a bad thing. That's not for me to decide. But I have known a lot of people that have been struggling through life that maybe have an addiction problem, maybe don't have an addiction problem, maybe they've made some bad choices in their past. But some of those people, at one point, I can tell you, I can guarantee you, they lit up the room. You know, maybe they just didn't light up the room for a couple years. And that's when this tragedy happened. And because they weren't lighting up the room and tragedy happened, it's like we care less.
Yep.
You know, so, but I also think the major point too is, if we're constantly saying that this person lit up the room and constantly saying that this person did this, but everybody has skeletons, everybody has bad shit that happened, and we're not going to learn anything, you know? We have to take these cases and dissect them, and that's, I think, how we can learn some stuff. I mean, I think, I don't want to get on too much of a tangent, but look at Jodi Arie's case, for example. There are so many women that I've talked to. Here's this lady that she's a scorned lover, stabs her ex-lover 27 times mm-hmm. in the bathroom. She's this horrible monster. But I've talked to so many females that say, well, what was going on before that?
Yeah, I know.
And they're not justifying it. And they're not saying that this guy deserved to die. But what was happening? And can we examine that more? And maybe if we do, then we can understand the case better. And I think, and that's the other question that comes up all the time, is dissecting these cases and going over and examining them, is it important? Is it necessary? Is it something we should be doing? I believe it's very important. I believe, like, if you look at the Chris Watts case, for example, mm-hmm. I think there was a lot of stuff going on in that marriage that should be examined. You have a family that lives in a house that they can't afford, that files for bankruptcy. And after they file for bankruptcy, they instantly have multiple credit cards that are maxed out and new cars on new car leases. That needs to be examined.
That should raise a red flag.
Well, because I think sometimes, look, we do live in a world that there's people like, you know, again, it becomes that argument, nature or nurture. You know, does Ed Kemper become the co-ed killer if his mother is not as verbally abusive as she was? I don't know. What happened to Dahmer to create Dahmer? I don't know. But I don't think those things were the same for Chris Watts. And how does he kill a wife that's pregnant and two, you know, kids? How does, you know, to me, that's as fascinating as a Ed Kemper. Because I think on some level with Bundy or Dahmer or Berkowitz or Kemper or some of these guys, you can go, they might have just came out of the egg wrong, you know.
but maybe not. You never know.
Right. You don't know. And I believe there's evidence to point that to point us in certain directions. I think Dahmer was going to go down that path no matter what. That'd be my argument. And then you look at, like, what OJ did. And it's like, is that a reflection of his childhood, some deep sexual fantasy? Or was it because he got hit in the head?
Mm-hmm. And has CTE problems. You never know.
Right. And But I think those things need to be examined. And I think we need to get past this notion that every victim is going to be the shining light that walked into the room. And what can we take away from it? I mean, I've watched a lot of video footage of Chris Watts and his wife, where she is degrading to him in videos that she was posting on Facebook Live. And maybe she was just teasing or playing around, but I think that's a part of the equation. Now, I think where it gets, where you can get twisted is when people then go, well, you're justifying why they got murdered. No, nobody deserves that, period. You know? But I think if we want to be honest, you can't have these cases covered by Dateline and think that you're doing anything good. You know, I really think these cases need to be dive into them and figure out how we can and grow as a community. And maybe also by seeing this stuff, you know, why in the hell does a father of two, soon to be three, how does this person not think that it was okay just to say, you know, I had enough and I need a divorce and I can go be with my mistress and raise my kids jointly with my ex-wife and have a relationship with her?
Harmoniously.
How does that not enter his brain? And his only way out was to murder his pregnant wife and then murder his two children. And then on top of that, then take them to a place and have to dump them into those towers. It baffles me. But I also think it's important, like I said, those things are important to talk about because, you know, your buddy gets a raise. Congratulations. How's your retirement? You know, like, you know what I mean? Like, if I heard about my friend going into massive debt or filing for bankruptcy or doing X, Y, Z, I would put him in that mind frame. Oh man, I don't want my friend going down the path, a negative path. You know, so I do think it's important to study all those aspects. But it's tough though too, because like I said, you talk one negative thing about somebody, the next thing you know, you're victim bashing.
I know. Oh, so it's everything. One person that you guys obviously that did light up a room was JonBenet. And two things on that, Duke Cap. One, when we finished up the last podcast, you said that's the show that people ask you the most about. Guys, do a show on JonBenet. You guys did a 5 or 6-parter. You guys broke down every possible thing. So obviously, congrats on that. That was a great case. What's the next most asked about case that you guys are asked to do right now?
On that case, where that was the first case, like out of the gate, websites up, email. Probably the first email was, are you guys going to cover JonBenet?
Of course.
And then the crazy stuff is when you see stuff like, you know, I always take a back seat to Nick. You know, he talks, I rebuttal, I toss in, you know, things here and there. I mean, what people don't see is behind the scenes, there's discussion on how this stuff is going to be laid out, what stuff we're going to be talking about. There's discussions about it beforehand.
Mm-hmm, of course.
So, but, you know, you get these crazy comments of people saying, you know, the Ramsey must have hired the captain as their lawyer. You go, look, I here's the conclusion that I came up with. And I've actually talked about writing a book. And so we've been talked, you know, several people wanted us to do a TV show that's probably never going to work out. Documentary. Who knows? If we did one, we'd probably just do it on our own, you know, finance this thing on our own. But, you know, been contacted probably every other week. You guys should write a book. And then you go, what do you want us to write about? Oh, just about how you guys met, blah, blah, blah. Who gives a shit about that? Like, I would like to write a book. John Douglas came out with a book. It's a great book for any like true crime person. The Cold Cases That Haunt Us. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of the cases that John Douglas was hired to go work. And he was hired to work the JonBenet Ramsey case. And I believe through every case that we've covered, I'm a facts person. I like to speculate as far as I like to have a couple beers and sit around the table with a bunch of guys and talk about a case and speculate. Maybe this could have happened. Maybe this could happen. But I think with the big cases that we covered, like JonBenet, I think you learn something definitive. And what I learned definitively on that case is this was a violent, vicious murder. And look, people can argue with me. Go look at the autopsy photos and then read the autopsy and then realize that that rope was so far into her neck that you could not see the rope. So when they initially found her body, they did not see the rope around her neck. And that's because this was a vicious murder. So when people say, oh, well, the Ramseys must have hired the captain as their lawyer, I'm not saying that they didn't do this. What I stated was this is a vicious murder. So whoever did this viciously murdered this girl. And that's all I know. And that's with a lot of these cases, that's as far as I get is one piece. I mean, I've read, I watched every single documentary you could watch on JonBenet. I've read over 4 books on the case, not to mention countless hours on YouTube. Even people that I've never even heard of, you know, just made a video about JonBenet. I'm like, oh, I'll check it out. And all I can come to my final conclusion is that this was a vicious murder, period. But I think it'd be interesting to write a book where I go through each case and just to present the one thing I learned and why. And I don't know if it's important or not, but I think in a lot of these cases we can come up with some definitives, and if we come up with those definitives, then we can come closer to resolve.
Your father
probably. I don't remember what your question was, but you got me all.
No, I got you all worked up on JonBenet. My question was, what case are you guys asked about to do now the most? Because obviously JonBenet was finished. So what case does everyone want you to do now?
It seems like we covered so many of them. Because for a long time, you know, Casey Anthony was really big to cover. I think just when things hit the news, mm-hmm. like there was a new lead with the Brian Schaefer case. So people started emailing about that. There hasn't been the Epstein, you know, Jeffrey Epstein for a while was a case that people wanted us to dive into. JonBenet is so funny too, because I don't know, for maybe 2 years, Nick said he'd never do it. So since he said he'd never cover the case, I was like, okay, cool. We'll never cover the case either. Mm-hmm. He said, we're never going to cover it. Fine. We'll never cover it. And it was him showing up to work one day and somehow we weren't talking about sports. We started talking about the JonBenet Ramsey case, and whatever I said to him just triggered something inside him. And a couple weeks later, he said, I think we should just spend a whole month on that case. And I was like, yes, because what people don't see is like, I spent 8 to 10 hours a day for the last 2 weeks editing this 6-part series and creating the music and creating the little bumper things and all that stuff and creating the ads. And now we got a case next week. So I get to wake up tomorrow and start a new case. And then once I'm done with that case, I got seven days to learn as much as I can about it. And then it's on to the next case. There's no stop. So sometimes there's cases in the news that we're kind of following, but to really like sink your teeth into anything, I mean, you need time. And so, you know, there's a lot of times where people will bring up cases that we've covered and I'm like, I know this answer, but I can't remember it.
You just mentioned you have to get up early, so I'm going to bang out. You ready for some quick hit questions to finish up, Cap?
Yeah.
What book you're reading right now?
Well, for the second time, two books. One you might like, the Beastie Boys audio book. It's amazing.
No, wait. Is that the one that they came out with? The hardcover book's the best because it has all different pictures in there and rare photos. I'm down with you listening to audiobooks, but that book itself is fascinating.
Yeah, but what's awesome about the audiobook is they got all these celebrities.
That might be better than the regular book, yeah.
And I also like when somebody's telling me a story and it's Mike D.
Yeah.
Telling you a story. And so it's coming from his mouth. And they also have all these like sound clips in the audiobook. But what happened was I listened to the whole audiobook. Mm-hmm. It was amazing. I bought the book. Mm-hmm. So then you can follow along with the book, with the stories. So it's my second time. And then I'm finishing for the second. So sometimes I'll do two at once. So I'll pick a crime book.
Yeah.
And then same way with movies, like I'm rewatching, this is going to sound hilarious. So book wise, I'm listening to the Beastie Boys book and also John Douglas's book, Cold Cases That Haunt Us, both for the second time. And then movie wise or TV wise, I've been rewatching Mindhunter. And at the same time, I've been watching old reruns of Gilmore Girls. So figure that out. It makes no sense.
Zero sense, and that's why I love you. There are a ton of true crime documentaries. You can't move a second on Netflix. You can't go from The Office without seeing 30 different true crime documentaries. We're oversaturated with them. Give me your two or three that if people are like, hey, Captain, you're the true crime guy. Give me two documentaries that I should watch. Give me two true crime documentaries that for whatever reason just hit it right.
I think the HBO four-part series on Adnan Syed was very well done. I think it also shows the humanity outside of the case. You have an individual that was, look, I know that case is very like Adnan's guilty or Adnan's innocent.
That's it, yeah.
Whatever side you're on there probably pretty hardcore. But when you see the pain that it's caused his family, the pain that's caused his father basically doesn't even leave the house. I think it shows you the humanity, and I think it shows you, we don't have one victim in any of these cases. We have hundreds of victims. So I would say that one for sure. Again, it's hard for me not to talk about the West Memphis 3 documentaries, Paradise Lost. I think as far as informative, they're just not as informative. Now, these documentaries are so in depth and there's multi parts. And if you go back and watch Paradise Lost 1, 2, 3, these were all done years apart. They weren't in the age that they could do a 6-part series. But I think those are fascinating. I think those will just, for me, will never get old. The Paradise Lost trilogy, which everybody knows. So I'd say Adnan Syed, the HBO 4-part series, is just really well done. And I also like the 6-part series, than Oxygen did on the missing Laura Murray.
Yeah, that was a good job. They did a good job at that.
I think they did a really good job of saying, here's what people think they know, and let's try to actually prove something.
I'm going to see.
Because, like I said, we covered JonBenet Ramsey for a month, and I guess I'm looking for some kind of praise or something, but I just feel like, I mean, I always thought it was just an accident, you know? Burke must have hit her on the head.
100%. That was it. He did it, and the family didn't want to lose another child. That was what kind of was like, hey, the underground, yeah, that's what really happened. That's what everyone always thought. And the truth now, older people, if they don't watch documentaries or listen to podcasts, they're like, no, that's what happened. I don't care what anyone says. That's it.
Right. And then you come in with, I mean, and the other thing too is, I mean, me and my father have never really talked a lot about cases, but for some reason, the JonBenet Ramsey case is something we've always talked about. And when the CBS documentary came out, we both got on the phone and I said, did you see that? Yes, I did. Yeah, well, that makes sense. Other than the fact that they left out all this information, you know?
They left out the facts. Don't worry about that.
Yeah, I mean, if a girl gets hit on the head and she's unconscious, okay, fine. So what happens if you choke a girl that's unconscious? She doesn't defend herself. She doesn't defend the action of being choked. But if we have evidence that on her neck that she defended the choke, trying to get the rope off of her neck, there is a thing called defensive wounds. It's something that we've known about for hundreds and hundreds of years. She has defensive wounds all over her neck because she was conscious and she was alive when whoever was choking her. So, look, that's in the autopsy. That's in the autopsy photos. That's fact. That's not some biased opinion some dumb podcaster that drinks beer in a garage has. That's fact. And if you do your research and you spend the time, and I'm not talking about an hour Google search, I'm talking about actual, I mean, I could not tell you how many hours I spent on that case. And I didn't get much further, you know. All I know is those are things that I can't dispute. And when I watched this great BBC documentary on the JonBenet Ramsey case, and they brought in forensic, you know, this whole forensic team, and their whole theory was, you know, okay, well, could she have been hit on the head and knocked unconscious first? Well, right when they saw those defensive wounds, they said, no, couldn't happen. Now, I'm not, I don't think it's impossible that she was choked for a time period to get those defensive wounds and then hit on the head and then choked again. I don't think that's impossible, but at some point she has to be being choked pretty hard and defending that action. I think we're in this weird gray period of crime where I think this DNA shouldn't exclude anybody in the family and shouldn't rule out any of these crazy people that have come forward and confessed to the crime, because I think the DNA is contaminated. But again, that's if you actually read the report. Why the DA exonerated the family is beyond me. It says in the report that it's possible that it's a single individual DNA, and it's possible that it's a mixture. And if it's a mixture, it could be 2 to 5 individuals. It says in the report. So if I have a DNA that possibly is a mixture of more than 2 or 3 people, that can't be credible DNA to test against. And I think it's also, we're in a weird period that it's like we're in the CSI period that you have to have fingerprints, blood samples, DNA, touch DNA, 5 eyewitnesses. You almost have to have too much.
You're right. To convict. Juries are contaminated by where's the DNA? Well, there's none. Whoa. And you're right with that.
Right, because then what happens is, there's no DNA. Well, then there's a possibility that this person didn't do it, so I can't sentence him to death. And then we have other cases that we have no evidence, no physical evidence whatsoever, but we have testimony of lying people, people that we know are known liars, and those people are behind bars spending the rest of their life in jail. It makes zero sense. But again, we have to, it's our job to create the world in which we live in. It's our job, you know, if you don't like the government, okay, change the government.
Make change, you know? Yeah, make change if you don't
and,
like it.
And you have to make small steps. You know, not every victim was an angel. Let's get over that. Let's move forward. It's okay to say that something's your favorite case. It's okay to say that you enjoy studying this. I mean, I think it's more a study of the psychology of humans than anything. But also, it's the study of truth. Mm-hmm. And our system needs to be more about the truth. And prosecutors need to be awarded not for their convictions, but actually finding the truth. And I think if we had, and we have a prosecution, we have defense, and I don't know if that's enough. I think there also needs to be some outside group that is working towards the truth. I mean, look, in a divorce case, you have the attorneys, mm-hmm, for the mother, you have the attorneys for the father, and then you get a guardian ad litem, which is basically an attorney for the kids. And I think maybe that's what our justice system needs. We have an attorney for the prosecution to get the conviction. We have the attorney for defense to stop that prosecution. And then we have an attorney that's for the truth. And if the truth comes out, it shouldn't matter if the guy has a parole hearing left. It shouldn't matter. It shouldn't matter. And that should be run by the state, because then when the state finds the truth, they can go, look, yeah, we might have been the ones that put you on death row, but we're the ones that figured out that you shouldn't be on death row. and the reason why it should be through the state, because if the state figured it out or the state did it, then you shouldn't be able to sue the state because of that. You know, because a lot of these people are going to stay in jail because the states are afraid of the lawsuit afterwards.
They're afraid of the lawsuits, and they're also afraid of, like, maybe the promotions that the prosecutor got, that the judge got. That's also a big thing.
Oh, yeah. And so if you had a separate unit, mm-hmm, it's not the prosecution's fault that he got the conviction. He's not the scumbag. It falls back on the group that was working on the truth. Mm-hmm. So if they figured out that he was wrong years later, it doesn't fall back negatively on anybody. But yeah, I mean, and some people would argue that there are, you know, there's groups out there working on these cases to try to get these people set free. But yeah, I mean, I
no, that's
this is why I have a podcast.
No, that's an interesting take, and I agree with it. I don't know if this next one's a fun one, if it's going to fit into your criteria, but I always have, you know, I have mostly athletes and stuff on. You and I are at a bar. You finally make it to New York. Who's the coolest person in your phone or coolest person that reached out to you about the podcast?
Oh, I couldn't remember her name. There's a show called Pretty Little Liars.
Oh, yeah. I actually watched that with my wife.
If you Google whoever the star is, I think it was through like Facebook story.
Okay.
Or Twitter or something that she tweeted about the show.
That's actually really cool.
And well, what was really cool for me was, and again, I wish I could remember her name, but I can't. But there's a singer-songwriter named Foy Vance, F-O-Y Vance, right? And I believe he's Irish, but Ed Sheeran loves him. Ed Sheeran's like a pop singer-songwriter. This guy is not. This guy is a, you know, the real deal singer-songwriter. And he's on Ed Sheeran's label. And he had this really great video called She Burns.
Okay.
And this same actress that played in Pretty Little Liars tweeted that she liked this record by Foy Vance.
Oh, shit.
So Foy Vance reached out to her and said, would you be in a video? She said, yes, I'll do the video for free. She did the whole video for him for free.
Holy shit.
And so I always thought, how cool of a girl is this, you know, to go, hey, I believe in your music. And yeah, you might not be super popular, and but I'll be in your video because I love your music, and which helped him get publicity. And I always just thought she was so cool. So the fact that somebody said, oh, she tweeted about your podcast, I was like, oh my God, that's crazy. And then also she was like the co-host for Ryan Seacrest, New Year's Eve, Rockin' Eve or whatever. She was the co-host. So the whole New Year's drinking with my buddies, I kept on going, she listens to the show.
She tweeted at me.
She likes us. But yeah, it just always cracks me up when like an actual celebrity, like meeting Chris D'Elia, which is a pretty famous comedian. Mm-hmm. He's now been in Eminem. I mean, if you're in an Eminem video,
yeah,
playing Eminem, you're a pretty huge comedian. And the fact that he has sent me and Nick free tickets and we've gone to see him multiple times, and just to know that there's these hugely famous people that I listen to, you know, and that helps me get through my bad days, that I'm somehow putting out a podcast that getting them through their bad days or just getting them through the day, blows my mind. You know?
Two more things, Cap. I was going to suggest a case to you, and then I realized that every freaking person in the world must do that, right?
Yeah, but maybe I've heard of it. Maybe I haven't.
I'm pretty sure.
That's the other one.
Yeah.
When they get mad that you haven't heard of a case.
Oh, I know. But I bet you heard of this one. The Eaton Patz case, obviously, from New York City, the six-year-old boy.
Yeah.
Okay, so.
Yeah.
But that one, I like that one because it's obviously where I grew up and stuff. And that was the first missing person case that kind of blew everything up. And how about the John List case from 71 when he killed his wife, mother, and three children in New Jersey, and then disappeared for 18 years, and then he was caught because of America's Most Wanted. That one always fascinates me.
Oh, that's a really good one.
Those are my two that I'm always like, do you know about this? Those two are my go-to read about. They're really fascinating cases.
Yeah, there was a kid that went missing in North Ohio in Portsmouth.
Mm-hmm.
Or not Portsmouth, Port Clinton. And I was just up there for a gig a couple weeks ago, and they found him in an abandoned house.
Oh, my God.
The kid was missing for several weeks. And they, like, searched this house multiple times, found him in a chimney. And now the speculation becomes, was he there by his own accord, or was it an accident, or was there foul play? But so any missing person case, but again, in the case where, you know, you kill family members and you go disappearing for 18 years, it's proof that people can go disappear.
It gives you the answer of both out things, but I want the truth on this one. This is my last question I have for you, and you got to give me one answer. One case that you want solved the most, or not that you need to be solved, oh, you don't care about that victim. One case that for some reason you're just consumed by and you need to know the answer to and you want to see resolved to.
I used to say JonBenet, and I'd like for that case to be solved, obviously. But as far as like needing to know, I don't know. I guess that's such a tough question.
You know which one that boggles my mind? I don't know if was it the Indiana Delphi cases, like down the hill when the guy tells the two girls?
Yeah, Delphi murders.
That one for me, I watching it, it infuriates me that no one knows who this is. That one bothers me the most.
Well, that one drives me nuts, and we talked about that case. We talked about the Brian Schaefer case and the Delphi case this week on Off the Record. And the Delphi case, I think because it's 3 years old now, and for 3 years they've been telling us that they're one step away.
Yeah, I know.
Well, I guess every case is always just one step away. You know, the JonBenet Ramsey case is one step away. Any missing person case is one step away. You know, the person comes back, oh, they're not missing anymore. So I also, it's just so tough, cause especially like when you know, we've met family members of the Delphi case. And so on some level, knowing them personally, you'd go, I really hope that they get answers, or like even going back to like Julie Murray. I mean, Julie Murray runs a CrossFit gym and she's sending me jokes about CrossFit and talking trash because she can lift more on certain lifts than I can. And to know that she knows that always in the back of my head, she's the sister of a girl that went missing.
Yeah.
So with those, you hope that these families get answers. But the question is, which one drives me the most crazy? And so if I had to be selfish, the Adnan Syed case.
That interesting answer.
But I also think it's weird too, because I think like, and I know it sounds like very conceited to be like, oh, I'd love to write a book. But like with that case, I think there's things like when we say quote unquote favorite cases, that case, which blew up because of Serial, I never listened to it. We were over a year into our show before I even listened to Serial. You know, it just wasn't my thing. I was the same age as those kids. I would have graduated with those kids. And that becomes a connection that you can't explain to somebody else. It's just like with the West Memphis 3 case. I can't explain to you my connection with Damian Echols and Jason Baldwin. I can't explain to you why I feel connected to them. That doesn't mean I think they're innocent or guilty. I'm just stating I can't explain to you why I'm connected to that case. Or when you look at the victims in that case, those 3 8-year-old boys, I remember being their age, the buyer's boy. You know, I remember riding my bike around with my buddies after school, one of us wearing our Boy Scout outfit because we had Boy Scouts that night. So I think there's certain little things that connect us to cases in such a weird subconscious level. But the Adnan case, I've spent so much time debating, and I have so many questions that aren't answered. At least with the JonBenet Ramsey case, I was able to sit down and answer a couple questions for myself. Mm-hmm. And with the Adnan case, as much time as I've spent on it, I still just have moments where... and I don't want anybody to feel bad for me, but I've gained 60 pounds in 2 years. I've gone and like seen a therapist because the stuff has taken over my life in a bad way.
Wow.
You know? But I have to feel on some level we're doing something good, that we're changing the world in a good way. Even if it's just making somebody's day more entertaining and more informative, I have to believe that it's doing something good.
I know you are. I'm gonna tell you why. We'll wrap it up with this. I know you are because in some of, you know, shitty moments, shitty this, and you need an outlet from whatever it is, no matter how bad your day is. It sounds fucked up, but it's a good outlet to put on you and Nick, listen to true crime or whatever. Or if shit's going on, you are the outlet. Even if the outlet is messed up stuff. Do you understand what I'm saying? Like, even if you have a shitty day, like, oh my God, you don't need to go put on a cartoon or laugh or listen to comedy. Your outlet might be a true crime thing. Maybe it gets you thinking, like, oh, maybe if that 1 hour, or though, you know, if you listen to two back-to-back episodes, those 2 hours and 20 minutes get you thinking, get your mind off whatever it is. So, listen, you know you're doing good. And I have to thank you before I have you do all your plugs. One, for speaking so passionately about everything. And that's why I really like having you on and like listening to you, because you're not run-of-the-mill, like, my favorite case is this. You get into stuff. We actually forget the questions we ask each other. You're so passionate. And I want to thank you for opening up about your dad, too, because you're throwing, oh, my dad was a detective here. You opened up about his job and everything, man. You were incredible. I hope this was a little different than 24/7 true crime, but give all the plugs. Crime Con, other things, the music, the social media, the Twitter.
I want to say back to your last question real quick is just the other day I was screaming at the top of my lungs. It doesn't make any sense that Heyman Lee, the victim in the Adnan Syed case, that her boyfriend never tries to make contact with her after she goes missing. And the day she went missing, he somehow has a written alibi and a written timesheet on the day she goes missing. Like, it doesn't make any damn sense at all. And why this person wasn't looked at baffles me. But if you want to have a drink with me, I'll be at CrimeCon 2020 in Orlando, Florida, the first week of May. And I will scream and yell like I do every CrimeCon, because it's just talking about cases and yelling. It's all it is, but it's a lot of fun. And check out our podcast. It's called True Crime Garage. We put out almost every week. It's two episodes. And you can find out all the other stuff at truecrimegarage.com.
And remember, if you get a retweet or if he DMs you back, it is the captain. It's not one of the millions of interns that helped him out.
Yeah. I wish we had an intern, you know.
Listen, my friend, this was an absolute blast. I know I'm sorry about your grandfather passing away five times. And, dude, I planned on doing 30 minutes with you. For you to do an hour and a half, I know you're crazy busy. We're recording this on a late Monday night. You're awesome. I love the show. Love everything you do. And I'll keep in touch, and we'll have a beer when I get to Ohio. Okay, my friend?
Yeah, and we'll make sure to do this again sooner than later.
Cap, you're the best, brother. Keep up the good work, and good luck with everything.
I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, brother.